Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81. a privilege it is to have Ron Carter on the phone with us here on Forbes Avenue. And what you just heard was Ron Carter, Bill Frisell, and Paul Motion playing 81. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Carter.
Good morning to you and yours.
I think that track is really interesting because it's something you co-wrote with Miles Davis, but it comes out totally different in a trio format with Bill Frisell and Paul Motion.
You know, I miss Paul. Paul was a wonderful drummer. He knew melodies, he knew form, he knew dynamics, he knew how to listen. And boy, drum world misses a wonderful influence on them as he's left the scene. It's always fun to play Bill. It's always fun to hear him. And I try to do that whenever I can to see what I missed last time working with him. a good band.
One thing that's fascinating to me about all of Bill Frisell's work, and for you too, is balancing that written music against the improvisation.
Well, I think two things, Mr. Gordon. We've kind of gotten used to leaving our ego at home, one, and two, bringing both ears to the gig. And if you have that combination, you find nice things to do.
You've played in large groups and led large groups and small groups. You've been in over 2,200 recording dates. What kinds of things stand out to you over the years of experience?
I'm always surprised that the calls I get that are not necessarily jazz bands or jazz-oriented gigs, so that after all the choices that they have, they decided this guy, me, has the best chance of making their music do something that they hope it can do. All the good players come to New York. That's what we're all about here. And with the travel situation being what it is, it's easy to get to New York in a moment's notice. So that they have chosen me for their projects is a tribute to recorded sounds and social media and stuff like that. But one of the things I've taken away from these concert projects is that we all got the same notes. Mm-hmm. We just find different orders for them. And I try to find them as quickly as I can for the various projects. It's fun to do that.
I get the sense that you're really adept at both leading the gang and being a supportive team member.
Well, you know, I think quietly, Richard, the band's bass player is both of those. He's always the band leader, and he always leads the charge, so to speak. You know, in any group, Richard, he's the only person, he or she, sorry, ladies, they are the only ones who will play every note all the time. That means they control the tempo, they control the changes, they determine where the beat is, they determine the pitch of the band, they determine sometimes the volume of the band. He or she is the only one that does each note, has this kind of effect. And I think once we understand that plural we are able to have even more fun going to work night in and night out, which is why I go to work every night. I like those challenges.
You're 87 years old, and you're still performing and still practicing.
Absolutely. Well, my birthday was May 4. I had some nice friends over to say hello, and I'm glad to see you make it this far, given the world. Well, you know, I can't get better, Richard, unless I'm practicing what I'm aiming for. My general practice plan is I go into my practice room, and I have a goal in mind. What can I learn today playing these etudes that I didn't see yesterday? If I can cover that kind of ground and make up for those kind of missteps, so to speak, I'm really ready to go to work tomorrow night because I really figured out something to do that didn't occur to me the night before.
When you're working on your etudes, I mean, they are divorced from the music you're going to play.
Yeah, but it's still the same notes, but just in different order, man.
So it's all about getting the tools in those fingers so that when your ears hear what the other guys are doing, you know what to pull out.
I want to be all over it. Absolutely correct.
We are chatting with Mr. Ron Carter and Pittsburgh, the home of our radio station, WRCT, is a great jazz tradition. I think of musicians like Dwayne Dolphin and Roger Humphreys and George Benson and Ray Brown, Billy Storen, Eric Blakey, David Eisenzahn, and many more. What kinds of memories do you have about either collaborating with Pittsburgh musicians or coming to town to play?
One thing, I miss seeing Dwayne often. If you see him again or talk with him, give my fondest regards and tell him I miss him.
All right.
Several of my school buddies from Eastern School of Music lived in Pittsburgh. And at one of our summer breaks, I drove from Rochester to Pittsburgh to pick him up and drive back to school. We had hung out for a weekend. 1958, something like that, man. No, 58, yes, wow. 58 or so. Bill Motzing, a trombone player from Pittsburgh, really played really well and wrote nice arrangements. My other view of Pittsburgh is the jazz club that they had there. What's the name of that place?
Was it the Grill?
Yes, Crawford Grill. Back in the day, they had a knowledgeable jazz crowd. They came and have a good time, but hear the music. They always wore the latest fashions. It's like I've been in New York, only in Pittsburgh. Loved it.
Well, there's still quite a bit of jazz being played in Pittsburgh, and there's even a church that has jazz vesper service every month. Yeah, it's really cool.
I miss Nathan Davis, too, by the way. He's one of my friends from doing the clinics up there for summers. He was promoting the jazz community's music in and around the city. Lovely man. I'm sorry he left the concert.
What is different for you about playing for a live audience, whether a club or a concert, or going into a recording session?
I guess three main things. The level of sound that's necessary, no matter how good the club is and how good their system is, the studio requires less physical effort to make the sound of the instrument, in this case bass, fill the room space. Mm-hmm. Secondly, given the quality of microphones and as engineers are learning to record the instrument music better, you needn't play so hard and so forcefully, literally, mm-hmm. for the duration of the gig in the studio as you would have to do in a nightclub. And thirdly, generally speaking, you're in a smaller spectator space. Generally, only the band is at the recording studio, so there's no other views or impressions you want to leave on somebody else who's not playing vis-a-vis the audience. In the studio, you're referring to and relaying to the members of the band, the producer perhaps, an engineer. So your focus is limited to five or six people, and it's a lot easier to control that than having your view, your emotional view, your physical view, spread out over a huge room with 2,000 fans.
Has it been your experience that it's easier for the musicians to communicate with each other in a recording session?
Depends on the gear of the studio. Sometimes they have good earphone sets. Sometimes they're prepared to not have any at all. It varies on the situation.
As an amateur bassist myself, I know how important it is to listen and to be able to hear everybody so that, as you say, you can set the pace for them, but also support them in whatever they're doing.
Well, I think a footnote to that, Richard, is that it's important for them to hear me, in this case, me, the bass player.
Right.
Each note I play, and sometimes studios are not geared for that level of bass sounds and notes available to the guys in the band. I've seen some pictures recently of a studio, when a quintet was playing in the studio, and they had everyone in the same room. And I think that's not going to be, that can't be productive for the bass player, because given the space they're living with or playing with, no one in the group, no matter how quiet they play, can hear every note he or she plays.
Right.
I kind of demand that, you know, and I know that that situation that they're in right there at the moment, that's not going to happen. I don't mind note to go to waste. I think it's impactful for all those reasons I mentioned earlier about each note that I play does those things, and I think that they're doing a disservice to the bass player and the musicians when they are unable to not literally hear every note he or she plays.
Sounds to me like you sort of favor the setup where the bass player is in a separate room but with a glass to see the other players.
Yes, and I don't know how much time you have, but I'll tell you exactly why I feel that way. In an open space where the bass player is in the middle of a room with no barriers around him, stacks of glass, the bass tries to fill all the space around it. Mm-hmm. However big the space is, the bass sound fills that whole area. By the time it gets to the microphone, the sound is so diluted because it's been played, it's been ringing around in this room for all this square footage, that the sound cannot be as impactful or as startling in sounding because the sound is delayed, it's decayed, it's dying by the force of the sound, by the time the force of the sound gets to the microphone, whatever quality it is. And I think to have the bass player more isolated in the room, that's a 6x6 room, it forces the sound of the bass, all of the sound, into the microphone that's now only 2 feet away rather than 25 feet away and according to the room. No, I'm not a fan of that at all.
That makes good sense. So you always work with a microphone, or do you, when you play live, do you sometimes work through a pickup?
All those factors are varied. Generally, I have a pickup from David Gage in New York, yeah. A realist that works really good for me. And the microphones, depending on where it's placed, depending on how close I am to the drums, depending on whether the piano lid is up all the way or halfway, mm-hmm. all those sounds are feeding to my microphone. Mm-hmm. And as a bass is only one instrument times four, or whatever size the quintet is, that microphone cannot possibly isolate enough from everyone else's sounds for the bass sound to be more present in his microphone, quote-unquote, his.
We are chatting with Ron Carter, and bassists out there, you're getting a lot of good tips here from Mr. Carter. As a teenager, I know that you switched from classical music to jazz, and I know that you also made a change from cello to bass, and my sense is that the jazz world is much more about can you play rather than are you from the right side of the street or the preferred race. Have you found that that's true, that the jazz community is more welcoming of more kinds of people?
That was the case back in the day. But I think if you take, Richard, if you take photographs of orchestras, classical orchestras, mm-hmm. say the big top five orchestras, mm-hmm. from 1967 to 2024, I think you will see that the proportion of minorities, people of color, the proportion of graduates from classical schools, and the proportion of them in classical orchestras is not much better in that 30 or 40 year span.
Right.
When I was coming up, it was made pretty clear to me that orchestras, while no matter how good I played, the management was not prepared to hire a person of color in those orchestras back then. And my position is, I'm not sure that much of that has changed given the photographs you find mm-hmm. on the internet. So having discouraged is a pretty strong word, but that's probably what it really was. A career in playing classical music, the jazz community welcomed me to New York to try to come to New York because all the players end up there. So there I was. I have not forsaken classical music. And if you didn't know my library, I've recorded some jazz classical mm-hmm. songs and other. Have a nice classical music library in my home of discs and music. I'm still aware of the music, and I will try to play it whenever I get the opportunity to. Every Christmas, for example, mm-hmm. school or high school orchestras and church orchestras need the extra bass players to handle the Hallelujah Chorus, or mm-hmm. they may have a Brandenburg Society that needs bass players during the course of the holidays. I'm always available to those concert groups that I play as many as I can, as my schedule allows, and the availability of them. So I have not forsaken them. I still encourage the music. I endorse anyone who wants to play that. Go ahead and get your feet wet and enjoy what it does for you. I'm the jazz player in the meantime.
That classical background, I'm sure, has influenced the way you approach practicing and the way you approach performing.
Well, I think the biggest influence for me was, Richard, was how to practice. Back then, the competition as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old was stunning. Of all the good players who were already ahead of me in background and experience, and know that I could kind of make those being the big steps so far ahead of me, not so far back, and kind of even the score, was to know what I had to learn during each practice time. So before I sat down to my cello at the time, I'd figure out what do I need to make this practice time allow me to do with more ease, or a new fingering, or better intonation, a better sound. And when my practice time was over at 2 or 3 hours, I'd stop and say, now, what did I learn this past two and a half hours, or whatever it was? Can I remember what that was? And translate that to the next practice time the next day. I still had that mindset, Richard.
That's one of the many things that you'd like to share with other musicians. I mean, all these...
Absolutely.
All this knowledge and experiences, and I know you want to help us all learn from your experiences. So you've got a lot of information up at the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
Yeah, well, you know, one of my concerns, Richard, this is my concern day, I guess, is that the most books that the jazz bass player is studying are built on playing, in this case, bass horizontally and as fast and as rhythmically and clean as possible. And I certainly admire that concept. My books are different than that. I try to teach my students to play as horizontally as possible across the bass, and my exercises are based on chords. Mm-hmm. My feeling, Richard, is that once the student understands harmony and what the chords sound like and what direction the chords are headed, what's the point of this chord going from this chord to this chord, and they see the result of that, they'll play the music differently because they understand the harmony behind the influence of these notes being what they are.
That's a very, very good point. And again, folks, you can find that information about the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
All right.
Now, Ron Carter, you are one of my favorite bassists. I think I told your people that you and Charlie Hayden and Slam Stewart and Dave Holland are probably my favorite bassists.
Well, great. I'm in good company.
But you have also been an integral part of some of my favorite jazz recordings. You know, the Herbie Hancock sessions with Cantaloupe Island and Maiden Voyage and so much great work with Miles. But I still love your work in the trios. One of my absolute favorites is that old record you made, Jazz My Romance, with Kenny Barron and Herb Ellis.
But, you know, I've always wanted to play with Herbie. I've known him for a very long time because I'm a Oscar Peterson fan. And, of course, Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen, he joined the band. And I said, well, my record contract list lasts two more records. I've got to get Herbie on a record, Herbie Ellis. And Kenny Barron was available at the time my schedule opened up, and I was trumping on a bit to try to track down Herbie Ellis and where he was and could he make this record with him. Well, we had such a great fun. He's just a wonderful guy. You know, wonderful sound of the rhythm he used to play, just a killer. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Carter.
Rich, good to talk to you, and I'm sure I'll see you in Pittsburgh. Forget to say hello.
And we're going to let the folks hear Sweet Lorraine from that very record, Jazz My Romance.
And please enjoy Kenny Barron. What a diamond he is. Thank you. Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT 88.3 FM. Today we're going to be talking to Maxwell Jones, PhD student in the Computer Science Department at Carnegie Mellon University, about AI. Thanks for coming on the show, Max.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Arch, and I'm super excited to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I started my undergrad at CMU, actually, Carnegie Mellon, doing an AI major. So I was in the Computer Science Department doing an AI major, and I also actually did an additional math major. After that, I did a master's in machine learning in the machine learning department at CMU, which was super fun. So I guess for my master's work, I did some research on style transfer with generative models for images. So this is like, you can think of generating an image and you want to generate an image in a certain style. And so the problem was kind of some specific version of that. During undergrad, I did some research as well. Not as much, but I did some theoretical machine learning research because I liked math. So I thought maybe I would like some theory. I ended up not liking it as much, but it ended up being cool. And I also did some fairness and bias research during undergrad. So you can think of like, you know, after a model is trained, you know, does it work the same on people of different races? What kind of correlations are there between captions outputted by a model and biases that humans have or biases that might be in the data? So after that, I started a PhD in the School of Computer Science, actually in the machine learning department. But I'm co-advised by one advisor in the machine learning department. So it's like Russ Lawn. He is like a super well-known, well-respected person in machine learning. He invented some of the seminal work in machine learning. So his PhD advisor was Geoffrey Hinton, who's like very well-known and like just got a Nobel Prize recently. So that's exciting. And I'm also co-advised with Junyan Zhu, who's in the Robotics Institute. And he does more generative model stuff. So I worked with him during my master's. And I guess now I'm kind of interested in sequential decision-making or agentic processes for vision, creative tasks. And I guess my long-term plan is to work in some video editing. So how can we make video editing easier for creators? How can we create tools to kind of be a prayer programmer or to help creators make cool stuff with videos? So, yeah.
Sure, that's really cool stuff. So all of the new talk these days has been about large language models like ChatGPT, and now the news about DeepSeek. Could you give a quick explanation to the audience on sort of how large language models work for the layman?
Yeah, sure. So I guess at their core, they take in words, right? Like I'll say, I don't know, what team did Michael Jordan play on when he was playing basketball? And so it takes in a sequence of words. And then it outputs a sequence of words. So this example could be like, maybe it'll output, oh, Michael Jordan played basketball for the Chicago Bulls. And maybe it'll even give you more information like, you know, he played in predominantly in the 90s where he won 6 championships. From an input-output standpoint, that's what's going on. And then like more formally, you kind of have some neural network, which is really just like a large set of numbers, weights, whatever you want to say. It's a function that takes in these words, transforms them into numbers, into vectors, and then does a bunch of operations on them, and then outputs the words. And so I guess there's all this talk of training. Basically, how like a large language model is trained is you just get sequences of words from somewhere. So typically, this is like from the internet. And then you train the model to be able to predict the sequences of words that you've seen so far. Right, so maybe on the internet, there's sequences of words like, oh, you know, what was Michael Jordan's favorite game to play? Well, he loved playing basketball. Maybe you train on that data. And I guess nowadays, the large part of large language models comes from the fact that you're training on whatever millions, billions, even like a trillion like words or tokens, which is like a kind of small building block that a word is made out of to the model.
Thanks for that explanation. So over the past couple of years, LLMs, ChatGPT, and generative AI in general, kind of like some of those generative image models that you were talking about earlier, have really come into vogue in the mainstream media, and everyone's hearing about it, and there seems to be a lot of investment dollars and work going into it.
Yeah.
But machine learning as a discipline has existed for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the factors that you think have created this shift or explosion in interest in machine learning more broadly, as well as technical innovations that you think kind of led us here? What are the most important ones?
So there's kind of two things. So the first is like ease of use. So I think ChatGPT was a big watershed moment for generative AI, as a lot of people will say. And one of the main things is because anyone could use it for free on their computer. Right? So it didn't require a special hardware, or you'd kind of have research machines to run the like neural networks or run the machine learning models. All you had to do was log into a website and then type something, and something would come back. Right? And so that's kind of what led to many millions of people trying it out for the first time. And I think that's what led to like people investing, saying, oh, this can be very useful, because people started to notice that, you know, ChatGPT knew about so much stuff. It knew about whatever use case they were trying to work on. And so then from, a more technical side, one of the main innovations with ChatGPT over previous large language models is this like idea of RLHF, or reinforcement learning for human feedback. And so without going into too much depth, I think the main idea here is that you don't only want to kind of reconstruct things you've seen online, but you kind of want to pick something that you think a human is really asking you about. So I guess the example that I like to go to for something like this is, let's say I train on a bunch of workbooks and a bunch of text from the internet. That's not a workbook, right? So maybe a workbook has questions like, oh, what is the capital of the United States? Followed by, oh, what is the capital of France? And maybe other things have words like, what is the capital of the United States? Followed by Washington, D.C. Right? So as a user, if I input in ChatGPT, what is the capital of the United States? I want it to give me the answer, Washington, D.C. But the training data might say, well, it's equally likely to predict what is the capital of France as the next line, because it's seen those two lines next to each other a lot in the training data. So this idea of reinforcement learning with human feedback is saying, well, actually, you should really output Washington, D.C. in these examples, because you should kind of have an idea. You should learn what humans are looking for. And so there was kind of some seminal work in that domain that really made ChatGPT super good.
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about resource consumption with AI and how that's going to be a growing concern as time goes on. And obviously, NVIDIA has become one of the world's largest companies off the back of powering AI training and inference. Can you explain to the audience a little bit why it requires such massive computing resources to run these models, and why these resources are so specialized to companies like NVIDIA?
So I guess, yeah, there's two questions. One is, why does it require so much resources? And so one of the things that like the AI community has found in the last 10 years is that the way to have a better model is to have a bigger model trained on more data. So if you want to have a general model that can do a lot of stuff, the best way to achieve that is by getting a lot of high quality data and training a very large model. And so improvements in the field of large language models, or just general models in general, which is what like a normal user wants to use, like a general model that can do a lot of stuff, then the best thing they do is make a bigger and bigger model that's trained with more and more data. And so as you get bigger and bigger models, right, the cost of consumption goes up. And so it's actually one thing that's important to note here is that the training of the model isn't actually like the majority of the bulk of the consumption. What's the bulk of the consumption is users querying the model, you know, millions or hundreds of millions of times, whereas you only have to train the model once. So I think that's basically the real reason. And then this NVIDIA question is kind of a separate question. So they have like the best like GPUs, graphical processing units that people can buy. And that's like a chip that you use to train a model. And so because they have the best things to use to train the model, and everyone wants to train the model, then they're super rich, right? So their main customer isn't like the layperson, like you or me or anyone who's trying to use these models. It's like OpenAI or Meta or other companies that are trying to train models at a very, very large scale, who need to buy these in bulk, right? And they're like pretty expensive per graphical processing unit or GPU.
Cool. So one of the things that's been in the news a lot recently is DeepSeek, and I know you've looked into it yourself a little bit. Can you explain what the hubbub was about with DeepSeek? Why was it such big news that they came out with their model?
So I guess, like, just going from what we were talking about before, like OpenAI has this, they have their ChatGPT, which a lot of people use, which is like super valuable. And they've raised a lot of money, right? And when they talk to investors, they say, hey, we need all this money because training is super expensive, GPUs are very expensive, and the more money we have, the better we can train. We can hire good people to train our models, right? We can hire smart people to train our models. And so we need all this money, right? And then Meta and all these companies that are buying NVIDIA chips are saying, hey, we need all this money in order to train our models so we can have the best model. The assumption is, hey, you give us all this money now, we'll train our models, and then in the future, you're going to get your profits back because we're going to have these models and everyone's going to use them and there's going to be some pay structure and somehow you're going to get your money back. So DeepSeek was a model trained by this like DeepSeek team in China. It's like a quantitative firm. They do some large language model training also. So like the large language model isn't their profit structure. It's more about like, you know, doing stuff in the market, some kind of financial math stuff. And so they trained a model, which they open sourced. So that means like not only can you use it like via a website, like the actual weights themselves are online. So anyone could download the model in theory and run it kind of either not locally, but they could run it without having to pay DeepSeek at all because they have the weights. And so they trained this model, released it, open sourced it so anyone could in theory download the weights. And it was on par or almost on par with the top models from like these US companies, so like OpenAI. I think the Meta model is not quite as good as the OpenAI model, or Google has a good model as well. And so I think the scare was, if we give these companies all this money, however, like another company could train a model that's just as good or basically indistinguishable that people could use for free, then kind of where's the profit coming back? So I think about this as a reason for like all the big market hubbub, as opposed to, oh, it only costed X dollars to train the model. So I think something that a lot of people talk about is, oh, it only costs whatever, $5 million to train this DeepSeek model, whereas OpenAI kind of, you know, has asked for so much money. Right? But I think one thing that's good to separate is like the cost of training a model from the cost of the research and development to know how to train the model correctly, and the cost of trying a lot of stuff out before you do your final single training run, right? So this cost of research and development and figuring out, you know, what the best model looks like, how to get the best data, how to clean the best data, right? That's where like all the costs are, as opposed to a single training a single model, right? So I think something I like to think about is, you know, they're a kind of a quantitative finance company, right? So maybe, and the paper itself had like whatever 40 or 50 people on it. Right, so you can think, and they've been working on this kind of direction of machine learning for 4 or 5 years. Right, so in the U.S., how much would the salary of 40 or 50 quantitative research finance people over 4 or 5 years cost? It's a lot of money, right? 40 people times 4 years times salaries north of $500K to $1 million to $2 million for a senior quantitative research person. So it's not as if this entire process costs $5 million. It costs significantly more. Right. But even with that being said, there's still a question of, is this monetizable if there's always a free version of the top model? Right. So that's still a question.
Interesting. So you would think that the human capital is like a pretty significant portion.
Yeah, that's the main portion of it is the human capital and also the capital needed to train different testing runs. Right. So when I look at the DeepSeek model and I look at their tech report, every single part of the process is clearly, to me, optimized very thoroughly, and many things are tested. Right? So maybe, let's say, I'll just say a number, there's 50 different things you could have tested. Right? They've tested all of those and figured out what works better than previous things for a lot of different parts. So that process of even testing those things, just the money to train different versions is going to cost whatever, 10x, 100x, the $5 million used for the final training.
Sure. You talked about open source models, and yeah, obviously DeepSeek V3 and R1 are open source models, mm-hmm, where the weights are publicly available. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as an increasing trend in AI, and what are some of the impacts of having these large models open sourced?
So this is actually a good question. And so the head of the machine learning department is Zico Coulter, and he's one of the board members for OpenAI. So I think he had some interesting takes about open source versus closed source as well. So I guess there are some companies that swear by open source, some companies that basically like only do closed source. So an example is like these DeepSeek, all of their model weights are open, right? Meta, all of the model weights are open. Right? OpenAI, no model weights are open. But at the same time, there's kind of a continuum of open source, right? So maybe on the completely closed end, right, is something like OpenAI, where all you can do is input text and output it, the model will output something. You don't know how big it is. You don't know how many weights there were. You don't know what it was trained on. You don't know anything about it. Right? A little bit farther down this kind of trajectory is like a meta model or a DeepSeek model where they'll give you the weights, but they won't tell you what training data was used to train the model. Right? And they'll give you a paper saying, hey, these are all the things we did. Right? But they'll say the data set contained this many words, but we're not going to tell you where it came from. Right, so this also isn't actually fully reproducible, right? Because you don't actually have the data that they used. And then on the other end is kind of something that's completely open. And so completely open, I think there's some examples. I think the Allen Institute for AI has some completely open stuff where that means they tell you the data set, you know, they tell you what the model looks like, they give you the model weights, and they write a tech report about everything that happened as well as all their failures. And given that information, you have enough information to perfectly reproduce their model, right? So you should ideally be able to get up to some level of error, like the error, like the exact same weights or very similar weights, right? So when people say DeepSeek is open, it's definitely more open than an open AI model, but it's not open in the sense that given the DeepSeek paper and infinite money, someone could reproduce their model exactly because the data is not released.
Interesting. Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Arjun Das, here with Maxwell Jones, AI researcher at CMU. Speaking of CMU, obviously a lot of really cool ML research happens here that you're aware of. What are some cool research or researchers that you would like to shout out as being particularly interesting at the moment?
So I guess I first want to shout out, I think my lab members are doing some really cool stuff. First, Shengyu Wang, who is working on data attribution. So this is actually a very hard problem. The idea is, let's say I trained my image generator on 5 billion images from the internet. And then I say, hey, generate me an image of a cat wearing a top hat. And I have some, and I get some cat wearing a top hat. Like, the question is, can I figure out which of those training images were very influential into making that cat with a top hat? And I guess the main idea is, if I know that, then maybe I can give those artists some residual pay, right? So you can think of an artist opts into getting trained to using their data to train with a model. And then from there, if the model generates an image that was based upon their work, they get some residual fee, right? This is actually an incredibly difficult problem from a mathematical and machine learning perspective. So Shengyu is doing some really cool work. I think also Gaurav Parmar and Nupur Kumari are doing some really cool stuff in the field of image translation and customization. So image translation is like, say you have an image of a car during the day. Can I turn it into an image of a car, like raining, right? Or can I turn it into an image of a car when it's cloudy outside? And so one application of this is like data augmentation for self-driving, right? So I guess more concretely, if I have a bunch of self-driving videos from the day, it'd be cool if I could generate self-driving videos during rain, so I can use that to train to make a very strong self-driving car that I think will work in all cases. And then customization is kind of the idea of, I have some personal images. Maybe I have some photos of myself. Maybe I have some selfies of myself. And then I want to generate like a high resolution professional headshot of myself, right? And so in this case, I'm only giving the model 5 to 10 images of myself as opposed to whatever it was trained on, like billions of images. And then can it use that kind of scarce data and its general knowledge about humans to then output a photo of me, but like say in a professional suit in a headshot?
A lot of really neat stuff. Thanks. So speaking of these generative image and video models that you and your lab are working on, what do you see as some of the important implications in the future and potential uses? Obviously, it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen in the future, but where do you see the impact of this work?
So I think there's a few things. So what I think there's kind of two areas that this technology can be very useful. And I think it's maybe a little bit different than what people think. So when people think of like, oh, I have like an image generation tool, they think of like, oh, like it's very negative. It's usually from a very negative connotation of, oh, it's going to replace someone. And so I think of it more as like someone with these tools can generate cool stuff much faster and can iterate on stuff much faster. So I'll give you two examples of like an expert with these tools being able to iterate much faster in the movie world, right? So first, like the movie Into the Spider-Verse, right? There was experts on the team that was like kind of designing, and they had AI tools that they could use to speed up their design process, to try things faster. And so to me, the result of this kind of technology is that experts can make a high quality movie faster, right? So we don't have to wait whatever 6 years for the next Into the Spider-Verse movie, which no one would like to do. We'd like to have a really high quality version in 3 years, right? That's as high quality as a version in 6 years without the technology. Right, so I kind of think of it as a continuation of any image editing software in some sense, where it speeds up the use for creators. Another use case is helping people who are typically non-creators create high-quality stuff that they can be proud of and learn more quickly. Right, so one example for me is, like, in the future, I'd love to make more YouTube videos, right? But some software like Adobe Premiere Pro or other video editing software is very... there's a lot of different tools you could use. It's very cumbersome, right? So it would be good if, like, AI could help me as a creator or someone that wants to be a creator create very high-quality videos, like, immediately without all the overhead, right? Or could help me learn more quickly what a good quality video looks like. So I think this is another use case, is kind of helping people who are not in the space or who want to get in the space, like, create things more quickly.
You speak of generative AI almost as like a force multiplier, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, something like that. And there's also like 3D assets or gaming is also another example that's kind of along these similar lines.
Yeah, so for our listeners who aren't machine learning researchers at CMU, but still want to use AI for positive impact in their own work, what are some ways that they can go about learning how to use these tools to boost their output?
That's a good question. So there's... a few things, I guess. So first of all, the internet is a great tool. So you can look up stuff. Nowadays, if I want to learn about something, I don't know that much about it and I can't find it like via Google search, I'll just ask ChatGPT, like, hey, I want to learn more about X thing. What are a set of things I should look up? Also, there's different AI tooling, especially in the generative AI space, that is... well, that's more accessible. That doesn't require super fancy hardware. So for example, a tool might be like Comfy UI is a tool. It's like a user interface for kind of using these models. So I think that has like a relatively low barrier to entry as opposed to like trying to code up something fancy.
Sure. In general, what are some tasks that you see AI being really good at? And what are some tasks where it really still has some room to go?
So I guess... And I was talking with some other like PhD friends about this. It seems like tasks where you're kind of just sitting around and like doing something on a computer like should be very automatable, especially kind of tasks that are not super long term, where you're kind of sitting down and like typing or doing something that doesn't require any like interaction with the real world as much. So one example might be like writing reports, like writing write-ups. Any write-up where what you're doing is kind of looking things up online, synthesizing information, writing things up in a certain format that's very nice, I think AI could be very good at. Right? Another example might be, in the coding world, might be kind of fixing a single error in like a coding library or like some kind of repository. I think that kind of task AI can be and will be very good at. Right? All these tasks are... in some ways still kind of short term in the sense that you don't have to do stuff for a very long time. So some things that AI in general is bad at is just anything in the real world. Right? So robotics as a field hasn't hit its kind of ChatGPT moment, as some researchers like to say, where it's very widely adopted and everyone is kind of using kind of generalist robots. Right? And so the reason for that is just manipulating things in the real world is just harder. Right? It's harder to iterate. It's harder to test a robot 10 times than it is to test some code 10 times. It's just fundamentally harder, takes longer. So I think that's an area where AI still has a long way to go. And then another area where AI might have a long way to go is kind of long horizon tasks, right? So I think one example is AI can perfectly pass maybe a job interview for coding where you're asked two very short questions. But can AI perform like a long-term like intern? Maybe this is more unclear. Right. And so I think people are working towards kind of this direction. But anything where there's super, super long like content that you have to create, I think is like much more difficult. Yeah, there's some types of things that AI I think might be like not as good at in kind of the social, like human aspect. So maybe like being able to synthesize new memes or something. Like something that's like you have to be really in tune with the culture to do. But I could eat my words on that one. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Watch out for the new meme AI model dropping in 2025,
right? Oh, God. Well, I guess we'll see. People will definitely try.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to come soon, if it hasn't already.
Yeah, I know there's like YouTube creators that just do like they do video essays where they like synthesize the video and like the and the script with AI, and so that's kind of I like a use case where you have thoughts as a human, and then you use AI as a mode to try to get them out there more quickly.
Yeah
or iterate on them more quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember hearing a really interesting perspective on what AI is good at and bad at. That things that are like really easy or instinctual for humans actually end up being the things that AI is bad at.
Yeah, like, it's weird.
You could teach a 5-year-old to catch a ball, but to teach a robot like how to move its motors to like, I don't know, play hockey or something is like very difficult. But you see little kids playing hockey everywhere.
Yeah. It's one of those things. I think I forgot who it was. Maybe Ilya or some big AI mogul said it has like this kind of jagged intelligence. Where the point is, it can do highly intelligent things, but it still cannot do very simple things. So like it learns in a different way than humans are used to, in the sense that it can do very complicated things while still failing to do very simple things, right? And so then the question is, how can you augment an AI to know when that's the case, or to do what that, or kind of to not have to do that kind of thing? So one example might be like multiplication, right? Like, you can make an AI that knows a lot of stuff, but then still maybe struggles with 10-digit multiplication. Right? But if the AI says, hey, you gave me a 10-digit multiplication question, let me just use a calculator. Like, maybe you can kind of patch some of these issues.
So as AI has been in the popular mind for a few years now, more so than ever before, do you think it's here to stay in terms of how people think about it? Or do you think this sort of initial burst of attention is going to go away?
I don't know. I think it's here to stay. And it's easy for me to say that as someone who works in the field, but especially after talking to like other people who aren't in the field or are in like high ranking roles at CMU or other places where you'd expect them to be more likely to say that it's not here to stay. I think everyone thinks it's here to stay. And maybe the reason is that, especially this generative AI stuff, it's so easy to use and it can give so much value that value will kind of like circumcede any attempts to completely like stop it, is in my opinion. I think there's so much value that it can be output to make people's lives easier that people will just continue to use it. And whether the people think about it differently is another question. But I think there's a lot of value in people continuing to use this tool. But one thing I will say is with humans in general, like we go through cycles of having super cool new technology or something that's super cool and new, not knowing how to use it. And then after we know how to use it, it takes us even longer to realize why it might be good or bad. And then to kind of die down a little bit using it. So one example might be like smartphones, for instance, right? So smartphones first came out, whatever, 2000s, right? They got so much hype. Everyone started using them, right? And to me, it's now or in the next 10 years that people are going to start being like, hey, it's actually really bad that I'm spending so much time on my phone. Can I find really good ways to not do this, right? Because we're not used to it. It's almost like a... it's like maybe like drinking in moderation or something, where when you're first introduced to drink, you don't even know what it is, right? So you're thinking, oh, like I can do this a lot. And once you start to realize the downfalls, it takes even longer to be like, okay, how can I work on this, right? So kind of humanity goes through these things as well. And so I think this is something that happened with smartphones, where people kind of use them a lot. We're kind of peaking in terms of how much we use them. And then people are kind of slowly being like, I actually really do enjoy like human connection. So in the last, whatever, year, I've heard more and more stories of people being like, yeah, I try to use my phone as little as possible. Or I'm actively trying to stop using my phone, which is something that maybe wasn't as true 5 years ago. So I really think that AI will go through something similar, where kind of right now everyone is using it. And in the future, maybe next 5 years, 10, depends, timeline is hard to say when things move so quickly. It'll get even more widely adopted and people will use it for many, many tasks. And then maybe at some point people will be like, we're actually losing some stuff for using it so much. But I think this is... if it's going to happen, very far away.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been super fun.
Yeah. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm your host, Archin Das, and I've been here with AI researcher at CMU, Maxwell Jones. Thanks. Have a good one, folks.
Peace.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.